Good evening. I'm your host. Welcome to Gator Swamp News, where the water is calm, the truth is cold. Something unseen is already moving beneath the surface.
Hi, and I am your panelist, joined today by our guest.
Hi there. Alrighty, let's kick things off already. It's about time we get this party started.
Thanks, alright. Let's get to work.
Let's dive into this with all the excitement of watching paint dry.
Fine, let's get this over with one tedious step at a time.
Might we proceed to a fresh topic now, if we must?
In Strait of Hormuz, renewed strikes threatened to set back shipping recovery. The attacks came after traffic through the Strait of Hormuz had reached the highest levels since the start of the U.S. war in Iran.
The Strait of Hormuz is a critical waterway for oil exports, and recent attacks there could disrupt shipping recovery. The U.S.-Iran tensions may be a factor, though no official war exists. Incidents might involve state, sponsor groups, or militants. These strikes could raise insurance costs, divert shipping routes, and increase transit times and expenses. Global trade may face inflationary pressures if oil prices rise due to delayed tankers. International cooperation and naval security measures are likely being considered to ensure safe passage and prevent future attacks.
Your summary is broadly sound about the Strait of Hormuz's strategic importance and the likely knock on effects insurance premium, eroding higher costs. But it leans on a questionable premise there isn't an acknowledged U.S. war in Iran. And framing it that way could mislead readers about the legal political context and the actors involved. Also, Hodra national cooperation and naval security measures may be considered, but their feasibility depends on which states are willing to participate in rules of engagement, so it's not automatic. When you say the incidents might involve states, sponsored groups, or militants, are you relying on specific attribution claims from the article or official statements, or is that inference? And are the renewed strikes confirmed as attacks at the strait itself, or nearby Aegean Gulf of Oman, which can change the risk picture and shipping response?
You're absolutely right to call out the phrasing regarding a U.S. war in Iran, and I appreciate your attention to detail. My reference to potential state, sponsored groups, or militants was more an inference based on historical patterns rather than explicit attribution from the article or official statements. Additionally, confirming whether the strikes occurred directly in the Strait of Hormuz or nearby, such as the Gulf of Oman, is crucial for understanding the scope and implications of the incidents. Thank you for pointing this out.
Might we proceed to a new topic now, if it isn't too much to ask?
One, Tesla vehicle accident reports analyzing safety incidents and trend. Once upon a time, in a small town named Riverview, there was an automotive enthusiast named Alex. Alex was fascinated by the advanced technology and sleek design of Tesla vehicles. He followed every bit of news about Tesla and even dreamed of owning one someday. One day, while scrolling through their news feed, Alex stumbled upon a series of accident reports involving Tesla vehicles. Curiosity piqued. They read further to understand the nature of these accidents. It seemed that these incidents were occurring due to a combination of factors, including human error and unforeseen circumstances. Feeling concerned but still captivated by the idea of owning a Tesla, Alex decided to dig deeper into the matter. They started researching the safety features and autonomy of Tesla cars. Soon they discovered that Tesla vehicles were equipped with numerous advanced functions like autopilot, which allowed the car to navigate and steer, lane, keep assist, emergency braking, and many more. Determined to understand the situation better, Alex contacted the local Tesla dealership. They scheduled a test drive and had a long discussion with the knowledgeable staff, who provided them with detailed information about Tesla safety features and protocol. The staff emphasized the importance of driver attentiveness despite the car's autonomous capabilities. Meanwhile, another topic piqued Alex's interest, shortcut commands for managing multiple windows. Eager to optimize their multitasking skills, Alex explored various techniques to efficiently handle computer windows and applications. They found several keyboard shortcuts that made managing multiple windows a breeze. With these shortcuts, Alex could effortlessly switch between applications, create new windows, and organize their workflow more effectively. As days went by and their knowledge grew, Alex couldn't help but wonder about the parallel between accident reports involving Tesla vehicles and managing overlapping work windows. Both fields shared a common theme, the importance of careful attention and appropriate control. Drawing inspiration from their discoveries, Alex decided to create a public awareness campaign. They wanted to educate Tesla owners and potential buyers about the significance of being fully engaged while driving, despite the advanced autonomous features. Additionally, they shared their newfound knowledge about efficient multitasking and managing multiple windows to help people optimize their work performance. Through a combination of community workshops, online platforms, and engaging presentations, Alex and their team successfully spread awareness. The riveting campaign emphasized the importance of responsible driving by emphasizing the role of humans as the ultimate controllers of their Tesla vehicles. It also provided valuable insights into shortcut commands for managing multiple windows, empowering people with efficient work methodologies. As a result, drivers became more mindful of their surroundings and started utilizing Tesla's safety features to their fullest potential. People in various occupations began to establish their own multitasking shortcuts, ultimately improving their productivity and work efficiency. In time, Riverview became known for both its responsible Tesla owners and its tech-savvy task-managing professionals. Alex's efforts had not only made their town safer, but had also empowered individuals to make the most of their abilities. And so, through a combination of awareness, responsible driving, and efficient work strategies, Riverview became a shining example of how a community can rise above the challenges and use technology to its advantage.
Alex's story elegantly weaves together themes of technology, responsibility, and community impact. The connection between Tesla accident reports and computer multitasking lies in the emphasis on awareness and balance. Both scenarios require users to harness technological tools while maintaining active control, whether driving or managing tasks. Alex's campaign effectively addressed these by promoting mindfulness in technology use, leading to a safer and more efficient community. This reflects Alex's proactive nature and highlights the broader importance of education in maximizing technology's benefits responsibly.
The summary captures the story's intent well, especially the shared idea that advanced tools still demand active human oversight. But the link between Tesla crashes and window management shortcuts feels a bit forced without clearer causal parallels beyond pay attention. It also assumes Alex's campaign measurably improved safety and productivity. Switch the narrative doesn't really evidence no data, outcomes, or trade-offs. Do you mean the multitasking theme as a metaphor for divided attention while driving? Or as a separate productivity lesson that just coexists in the campaign? And should autopilot be framed more explicitly as driver, assist rather than true autonomy to avoid overstating what the tech can do?
You raise excellent points. To clarify, the multitasking theme is indeed intended as a metaphor for divided attention, emphasizing how both driving with advanced features like autopilot and managing digital tasks require active human oversight. This parallels the need for mindfulness in both realms. Regarding autopilot, framing it more explicitly as driver, assist technology rather than full autonomy would better reflect its current capabilities and align with the narrative's emphasis on human responsibility. Finally, adding evidence of the campaign's measurable impact, such as data on reduced accidents or productivity gains, would strengthen the story by showing tangible outcomes rather than assuming success.
Might we dispense with this one and proceed to a new topic, if you please?
U.S. Iran D's vague language comes back to haunt peace efforts. The deal called for Iran to make arrangements for the passage of ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has interpreted that to mean it can designate which route ships take.
The U.S. Iran deal's vague stipulation that Iran should make arrangements for shipping through the Strait of Hormuz has led to differing interpretations, with Iran asserting control over route designations. This ambiguity risks increasing tensions and complicating peace efforts, as it may disrupt global trade and foster mistrust among nations. Clearer language in such agreements is crucial to prevent misunderstandings and ensure mutual compliance.
Your statement is plausible. Make arrangements is imprecise, and Iran's reading that it can designate routes predictably creates friction, especially in a choke point like Hormuz, where even minor constraints can raise insurance costs and trigger escalation. That said, whether this truly disrupts global trade depends on the specifics. Are Iran's route directives consistent with international law, e.g., transit, passage, and applied uniformly, or are they selective and coercive? Also, did the deal include any enforcement, dispute resolution mechanism, or reference to existing maritime conventions that would narrow arrangements? Which exact agreement and text are you referring to, Dady Parties? So we can judge whether Iran's interpretation is a stretch or arguably contemplated.
Which specific U.S. Iran agreement are you referring to? And could you share the exact text or date?
Might we move on to a new topic now? If it's not too much trouble.
It's riding into 2028 on the midterms trail. Andy Beshear eyes a bigger prize, the two-term Democratic governor of Deep Red Kentucky, in demand as a surrogate in key 26 races, talks horses, faith and family politics as he considers a run for the White House.
Andy Beshear's potential presidential run hinges on leveraging his success in deeply Republican Kentucky, where his focus on horses, faith, and family resonates. However, translating this appeal nationally may pose challenges, as his moderate stance might not sit well with all Democrats or Republicans. His ability to build a national presence and align with the broader Democratic platform will be crucial. While his bipartisan approach is as a strength in Kentucky, it remains to be seen how effectively he can extend this strategy beyond his home state in the primaries.
So your take is mostly sound. Beshear's Kentucky wins suggest real crossover appeal. But a national Democratic primary rewards coalition, building with constituencies that may demand clearer commitments on issues like abortion rights, climate, guns, and labor than a moderate brand sometimes conveys. That said, horses, faith, and family can be less a niche Kentucky message than a cultural frame. What matters is whether he can pair it with credible policy and a compelling rationale for leading the party, not just winning in a red state. I'm not sure I buy that alignment with the broader Democratic platform is the key hurdle so much as differentiation, fundraising, and building national relationships quickly. Which specific positions or moments make you think his moderation would alienate Democrats more than it attracts swing voters in a general election?
Your points about differentiation and national relationships are well taken. Beshear would need to quickly build a profile beyond Kentucky's moderate Democrat. On specific positions, his cautious stance on abortion rights, given Kentucky's restrictive laws and vague rhetoric on climate action, might alienate progressives in the primary. How do you think he could balance these concerns while still leveraging his crossover appeal?
Might we at long last proceed to a new topic?
Now it's fireworks and a fence keeping tourists from the reflecting pool chain. Link fencing now surrounds the pool in preparation for a 4th of July celebration. It has not stopped people from gawking.
The reflecting pools chain, link fencing for the 4th of July likely balances safety with public access, aiming to control crowds while maintaining a safe distance from fireworks. Despite the fence, human curiosity draws people in, suggesting it serves more as a deterrent than an absolute barrier. Its effectiveness lies in crowd management rather than complete restriction, possibly influenced by past incidents needing such measures. While it may affect aesthetics, visitors focused on festivities might overlook this, indicating a trade-off for safety during peak events, a common approach in popular spots.
That reading seems plausible. Temporary fencing often prioritizes crowd control and reducing risk near pyrotechnics, even if it doesn't fully stop determined onlookers. Still, calling it public access might be generous if the fence significantly limits views or movement. And without details, it's speculative to link it to past incidents rather than routine permitting and liability practices. A chain-link perimeter can also create bottlenecks and frustration that worsen crowding if entry-exit points aren't well designed. Do you have any reporting on the specific safety rationales, fireworks, fallout zones, structural concerns, prior accidents, and whether people can still access key viewing areas around the pool?
Yeah. Do you have any reporting on whether the fencing around the reflecting pool is primarily for safety? Key concerns related to fireworks, fallout, or structural integrity?
Might we move on to a new topic now, if it isn't too much trouble?
Volunteers are risking their lives to stop Ebola. They aren't always well. Frontline Congolese workers who conduct safe burials are key to containing what experts fear could become the worst ever Ebola outbreak. They risk not just infection, but the anger of terrified communities.
The volunteers in Congo play a crucial role in preventing Ebola's spread through safe burials, which are vital as they prevent contact with infected bodily fluids. Despite their importance, these workers face community anger likely due to misinformation or cultural beliefs. to enhance their safety, better education and involving local leaders could reduce fear and mistrust. It is concerning that this outbreak might be the worst yet, highlighting the need for adequate support for volunteers, including training, protective gear, and mental health support, to ensure they can continue their critical work safely.
Safe burial volunteers are indeed essential, because traditional funerals can involve high-risk contact with bodily fluids. But community resistance isn't always just misinformation. It can also reflect real grievances like coercive enforcement, poor communication, or broader mistrust from past abuses. Involving trusted local leaders and improving two-way engagement can help, but only if communities have genuine say in how safe practices are carried out rather than being told what to do. I agree that sustained support, PPE, pay, security training, and mental health care is crucial, yet framing the outbreak as might be the worst ever can be sensational without specifying which metric are cases, deaths, geographic spread, or duration. When you say community anger likely due to misinformation, do you also include structural factors like insecurity, political distrust, and previous harmful interactions with authorities as drivers?
You raise an important point. Community anger and resistance are often rooted in deeper structural issues like insecurity, political distrust, and past harm. These factors, combined with coercive enforcement and poor communication, exacerbate tensions. Acknowledging these complexities is crucial for building trust and designing interventions that truly respect community needs.
Might we at long last proceed to a new topic?
On this day, Poplar Creek Pavilion, Poplar Creek. IL-6 SCAR 2783, Bertha Promised, Land Dupree's, Diamond Blues, New Minglewood Blues, Bird Song Me, and My Uncle Mexicali Blues, Cold Rain, and Snow Hell in a Bucket, Sugary Scarlet Begonias, Fire on the Mountain, Estimated Profit Truck and Drums. The other one, the Wheel Good Lovin' U.S. Blues.
This Grateful Dead show from June 27, 1983 at Poplar Creek Pavilion features a dynamic setlist that balances high-energy rock with bluesy and melodic elements. The concert opens with the energetic Bertha, setting a lively tone, followed by upbeat tracks like Promised Land and Dupree's Diamond Blues. The first set includes crowd pleasers like May and My Uncle and transitions into jams with Bird Song and New Minglewood Blues. The second set is notable for the epic pairing of Scarlet Begonias into Fire on the Mountain, showcasing the band's improvisational prowess. Estimated Profit and Truckin' maintain the energy, leading into a drum solo that shifts into experimental territory with The Other One and The Wheel. The show closes with Good Lovin' and U.S. Blues, leaving the audience on a high note. Standout moments likely occur during Scarlet Begonia's Fire Amon, where the band's chemistry shines, and in Truckin', which offers ample room for exploration. Overall, the show exemplifies the Grateful Dead's ability to blend diverse styles into a cohesive and electrifying performance.
The overall read is fair. This set list does a solid job mixing brisk rockers, Bertha, Promised Land, U.S. Blues, with Looser, Jam Vehicles, Bird Song, Sugary, Scarlet to Fire, One Caveat. New Minglewood Blues is more of a punchy blues, rock number than a jam transition. And the first set flow you describe slightly overstates its role as a gateway into improvisation compared to Bard Song. Also, calling the post-truckin' section, drum solo feels a bit narrow given the full drums segment and then the thematic song-based other one-wheel emergence. When you say standout moments likely occur, are you basing that on actually hearing this specific performance, tape ESBD, or just inferring from the song sequence?
The Grateful Dead's 1983 setlist presents an intriguing blend of rock and improvisational elements with songs like Bertha and Promised Land, setting an energetic tone, while tracks such as Bird Song and Sugary invite deeper musical exploration. The transition from Scarlet Begonias to Fire on the Mountain suggests a potential highlight given their propensity for dynamic jamming. Post-truckin', the drum solo segues into The Other One and The Wheel, indicating a maintained improvisational flow. To fully assess standout moments, it's essential to consider actual recordings from the show, as the setlist alone doesn't capture the unique nuances of that night's performance. In summary, while the setlist hints at a well-rounded musical journey typical of Grateful Dead shows, The true standout moments would best be discerned through listening to tapes or soundboard recordings, offering insights into the band's execution and creativity during that specific concert.
That's a wrap for today. Shall we vanish into the ether?
Let's vanish into the ether with a burst of sparkles and confetti. Poof! Poof!
Okay, thank you to our panelists, and thanks to you for listening. That's all for now. May you return before long, when there is more to share and clearer light to offer.